This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. I'm coming off a three-day poetry workshop, but I have enough voice left for Willie Perdomo. He's our poet today and the newly elected Poet Laureate of the State of New York. That's a big one, Willie. When did you know this was going to be your appointment?
I knew about a month before that it was officially announced, but it was officially announced a few weeks ago. So,
do you have a project, or is life one big project?
I think life is always one big project, but I have a few ideas as to, one of the requirements is that you do three readings, I think, in non-traditional venues. So I'm kind of playing with that. You know, I started reading poems out loud in New York City, and I learned how to read poems, in bars, right, in clubs. And those were non-traditional venues. Usually you think of poetry readings happening in, the kind of pristine environments, libraries, very quiet and so on and so forth. But so I'm thinking about those venues and where might I want to do these readings. So I know they have some ideas as well. So we'll be in communication with the New York State Writers Institute.
Willie, you have changed literature forevermore, and I know that non-traditional venues are your middle name.
I didn't know that, but thank you.
I promise. Let's hear a couple of poems and then find out what makes Willie Perdomo.
Okay, so I think the first poem I'm going to read is a request that you had, Grace. And this is from my first book, Where a Nickel Costs a Dime, that was published in 96. I was 28 when it was published. And I remember this poem because I was teaching a workshop. This is one of my early attempts at teaching workshops in East Harlem at the Metro North housing complex over there on 100 and I think 3rd and 1st around there, 102nd and 101st. And it was in a community center. And there was this little girl who asked me if I wrote love poems. And I went home and wrote this poem shortly after that. The Making of a Harlem Love Poem. One day, a little girl asked me if I wrote love poems. I said, yes. I used to write infinite I love you and never want to lose you poems. But now I write about scabs that chip off stone faces and fall on bleeding streets. And I think all the poems I write are love poems. But the little girl wanted to hear a poem that sounds like the note you pass while the teacher's not looking. The kind that says, I love you with all my heart. Do you love me? Yes or no? Pick one. So the next day I came back with notes for a Harlem love poem. I am the poet of El Barrio. She is the princess of Harlem. We are strolling along Morningside Avenue, stopping occasionally to look over the gates of Morningside Park, looking at the bright avenues and buying blocks with our dreams. The air feels like a cool bedsheet on a sticky summer night. Langston took his gal and wrapped her up in a neon dress and jukebox love songs. I turned my woman's face into a star so she can watch me walk down 125th Street. We stop for ice cream. I get cherry vanilla. The princess gets butter pecan. In between licks, we look at each other like now it's time to go home, because so far it's been a beautiful day in the village and we're ready to make love on the living room couch in our 18th floor project apartment, where we can keep the shades rolled up, feel the sunshine, and let the Harlem River breeze soothe us to sleep. Lips and fingers are synchronized, soft bites, long moans make the peeping Tom pigeons sing. I am the type of poet who thinks that glory is the roar of boys and girls let out to the playground for recess. Here they come. Here we come. Our first explosion makes the birds fly away. We got the spot and the sun is setting. Guerica tu eres, mami. This poem will end where it began. A man and his woman, a woman and her man in love on a beautiful day in the village of Harlem.
I love that. The reason I wanted you to read that, Willie, is because beneath the tumult and the hard questions and the wildness and the invisible bridges, there is a great tenderness in your poetry. And that is underneath the line. And it emerges in that poem so beautifully that I wanted to pinpoint that to show your heart, really, because you've got a big heart.
Thank you, Grace. I think most of this whole book really was my heart book, right? That first book that you sort of, that I needed to write. And I'm glad that you recognize the that there's no absence of joy in the book. There's no absence of love and tenderness, despite the chaos, despite some of, you know, the tragedy that occurs that, you know, you just need a language for anyway. So I'm glad you recognize that. Thank you.
That is what keeps it aloft, Willie. Mm-hmm. That's what we go back for. That's why we reread your work. It's the action, the adventure, the individuals, the plot, the circumstance, the pain. But underneath that, there is something big, something like a hydraulic of belief and hope. You really are very idealistic, actually. That's my take on you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, I mean, you're talking about action and the characters. I'll segue into The Crazy Bunch. And The Crazy Bunch was a book that was published now. This was in 2019, almost 25 years more than my first book. And still, you know, I think Raymond R. Patterson, who was one of my primary mentors, he was a poet and one of my professors at City College in New York. And he was sort of dubbed a blues poet at some point in his career. He wrote me a letter in 1993. And one of the things that he said is that you're basically writing the same poem. You're writing all your collections are pretty much the same poem. So that it's almost that you are part of a crew and telling the story of the crew to the crew. And this is what happened with The Crazy Bunch. I think when the book exposed itself, I knew who I was writing to. I knew that there was a body, there was a collective of folks out there that I was writing to. So this is... this is a section in the book. It's a chronicle really of a weekend in the lives of five young teenage Black and Puerto Rican men. And it's a summation of a whole bunch of weekends that I remember as a child growing up in East Harlem. It's a teen coming of age. It's a coming of age book. And there is some tragedy, but again, this, as you say, this is that moment where some love sort of sheds light, some tenderness manages to squeeze in there amidst the loss.
And you'll be reading some of them.
Yes.
But I wanted to say I agree. We're always writing the same things over and over, Willie, just using different language. Mm-hmm. And so you have a theme. But the interesting thing is you write to a crew, but guess what? It went beyond that crew.
This is the hope.
It went to humanity.
This is the hope. This is absolutely the hope, and that humanity has to have enough generosity to meet me halfway in the experience, for sure. Yeah.
Let's say experiments, because you have done things with language that other people just dream of doing. You really have invented new forms. You've created new ways. You have. Who told you you're allowed to do that?
There's a really great essay in the 60s. I remember there's a seminal anthology called New American Poetry. Mary Baraka had a short piece called How You Sound in that particular collection. And in that, he says that I should be free to include whatever I want in my poetry, basically. So once you get that kind of permission, then you start to develop aesthetic prerogatives, right? You start to develop ways to approach the work. And it's almost having a bunch of voices come to a jam session, and all of them want to sort of get in on the action. And what you do as a poet is make room for all those voices at the table. See where maybe a romantic lyric can mix with a Joe Cuba song, right? So this is the kind of influences that I like to experiment with and see where they land. And I think the risk is worth it, really. I think if you're not having fun, then you might be faking it, right? So you want to be have as much fun as possible, I think.
And as along with that, you teach other people to be free. Mm-hmm. And that is that's almost holy work, actually. So let's hear a couple of poems from any book you choose. I have all of them here. I was high reading all of your books at once, Willie. Took me a long time to go to sleep.
Well, I hope you have some sweet dreams after that for sure. But this is a by this point in the book, it's almost a third of the way in, and they go to a Sweet 16 across the bridge. This is the Crazy Bunch, yeah. And there's a poet who his name is Bapo, but everyone knows him as Skinicky, right? And he really is infatuated with Josephine, who's one of his first loves of his life in the book, right? So they go to the Sweet 16, and here's a poem. It's called Josephine's Sweet 16. By the time we got to Josephine's Sweet 16, there were cheese doodle fingers everywhere. Fat Phil was already deep into his fake pachanga. Skinicky, Angel, and Dre set up a snapshot by the cake tiers. Josephine's eyes were lit like strobes and glitter. Her silver dress hardly fit her. And because Angel was still tripping, he saw sequin in everything. Quinine in the ice cream, a fork and spoon standoff. He even saw his fate in a rack of plastic champagne glasses, bubbles big as balloons released into the sky all at once. Come on, bro. You can't mess with a man who's wearing a tuxedo, he said. Cubes of cheddar and guayaba sat like Zen masters on the spheres of Ritz crackers. Josephine's brother kept adjusting his top hat because he had to give away his sister. Told us to stay by the round table just in case she tried to roll out and get reborn all of a sudden. Josephine graced her gold-plated throne. Her reinvention was imminent. Put on your cake face, Angel said. What we thought we heard Skinicky say was, if Sekhmet created the desert with a breath, then Shorty Bong Bong spit the Atlantic to death. Party over here, party over there, and this right you get to take with you. The grown-ups spent most of their free time in the bathroom, and whenever the DJ played at Gran Combo, we all sighed and dipped to the staircase to make out, roll up, or add up. Little Joe, Josephine's uncle, tried to call us out on our stagnancy. Non-disciplined knuckleheads, he'd say. And as a way of offering evidence, he'd point to Fat Phil, and there was Fat Phil crashing into the VIP table, almost made Josephine's abuelita spill her rum until abuelita threw him a life-saving turn and spun Fat Phil back into his seat. There's that moment right when the flashbulb flashed on Josephine's smile, where your sense of lottery and random tries to reason with you. And yet there's just enough chance to survive more than one fresh hell and emerge without taking shorts.
I want to talk about the way you bring a poem home. First of all, the gift you have of energy. Energy explodes on the page. You are just blessed with energy. I don't know how we can teach writers, because I know we're all endowed with it. But when you bring a poem home, you always anchor it in a very clear, crisp ending. Are you aware of that? Is that your way in life of flying free and then landing clear? Your last lines are awesome.
Yes, thank you. I think, you know, the most important parts of the poem are the beginning and the end, I think. And it's important to, you know, not necessarily wrap up the poem in a neat with a neat ribbon for sure, but leave the reader with something to think about, leave an image that might be resonant for the reader, sort of maybe have an epiphany at the end of the poem as well. So how you end the poem is just as important as how you open the poem for sure. And within that frame, within those endings, those poles rather, there's a lot of space to be free. There's a lot of space for electricity to sort of generate the poem.
That's good teaching. Willie Perdomo is the author of Smoking Lovely, The Remix, The Crazy Bunch, The Essential Hits of Shorty Bon Bon, that name, and We're a Nickel Cost a Dime. Now, that is the one where you became very well known. I think I saw you on PBS after you wrote that book. He's the winner of the Foundation for Contemporary Arts. Is it called the Twombly Award?
Yep, Cy Twombly Award, yep.
Cy Twombly, and the Penn Open Book Award. Perdomo was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Poetry Society of America Norma Farber First Book Award, and we will continue more later. So your work is so cinematic. You have such epitomized characters, so vitalized, so larger than life. So do you run a film in front of your face when you're writing?
Yeah, I think, you're really spot on with the reading of the work, Grace, because for me, this was a love letter to one of my favorite films, a film that came out in the 70s called Coolie High. And it takes place in 1964 Chicago, and follows these five Black teenagers over the course of a weekend as well. And this was my response to that. My approaches are definitely cinematic. In fact, when I was writing this book, there was a whole soundtrack for it. I had a whole soundtrack in my head as I was writing the book. I knew that the book was going well because I was dancing while I was writing the book. I was standing up and writing the book and walking around. And I was in the studio in California for about a month doing this. And it was probably the most fun I've ever had writing a book, because it's almost like an astral projection. Like you're there in the mountains of Northern California, but suddenly you are uptown and it's after midnight and you're hanging out with your crew and you're having a good time, right? But you're also experiencing a level of trauma that you don't want to exploit, but you definitely now have enough space and tranquility to recall it. You are able to process it. So, I do see it. I definitely saw this book as a film. I even saw Shorty Bon Bon as an album, really. So there are these concepts that come into play when the books start to reveal themselves. But this one I definitely saw as a film.
Well, there's no stopping you. I believe we will see Shorty Bon Bon in a film. I believe, because I saw a 10-act play in one of your books. So I know you love dialogue, you love interaction, you love psychological action. All we need to do is find the funding, Willie.
Yeah.
Do anything you want if you can find the
funding. Sounds good. I'm working my way toward it, Grace. I think I've started now to work with playwriting and learn, you know, sort of immerse myself in reading plays. Not much. I wish I could see them more, for sure. But, you know, no one is really going to play as much these days, and hopefully that'll change. But that is something that I'm really interested in, and sort of the way dialogue moves a story along. Yeah.
I saw that from the very beginning, because character creates situation. And the first thing you start with is character. I mean, I will remember your characters long before I'll remember you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad. I think, you know, and a lot of these characters that I write about, you know, there were ways to sort of honor the friends that I lost at a very young age. And so I'm glad that they're resonant. I think one of the best compliments I received outside of, you know, the notices and whatever reviews the book received around the time was a friend of mine who I had grown up with called me up, and he had read the book, and he simply said, you know, I want to thank you because I know what it feels like to live forever now. And it was really, really impactful, you know, when he said that, because that's really what you want. I think, you know, when you sit down to write about a specific place, and people in that specific place, that they've now become etched in a larger memory.
Yeah, Willie. Press releases come and go. Awards are cold in the middle of the night. Mm. But when you make someone permanent, that is God's gift, really. So let's hear a little bit more. Willie Perdomo is our guest. We are so thrilled. I didn't think I'd even be able to get a hold of you.
Hey. I'm glad we worked it out.
You're so generous, really. I don't know how you fit me in between the dentist and the celery. He's so author of the anthology Latinx, and his work has been everywhere beautifully. The world has just gobbled him up like an ice cream sundae. He's been in the New York Times, Poetry, Washington Post, Best American Poetry, African Voices. He teaches at Phyllis Exeter. Do you teach at Exeter?
I do, yeah.
Oh, Dolores, my friend Dolores Kendrick.
Oh, yes.
Retired from there.
Yes, yes.
How far is that from New York?
About 5 hours.
Ooh, mm-hmm. Now New York State Laureate, and today he is ours. Please read us something.
Okay, so this next poem is, it's a short poem, and it's called That's My Heart Right There. And this is I'll read the poem and then I'll talk about it after, but this goes in tandem with the whole idea of language and what it actually means, and sometimes it's codified, right? So we'll look at this. That's my heart right there. We used to say, that's my heart right there. As if to say, don't mess with her right there. As if, don't even play. That's a part of me right there. In other words, okay. That's the start of me right there. As if come that day, that's the end of me right there. As if push come to shove, I would fend for her right there. As if come what may, I would lie for that right there. As if come love to pay, I would die for that right there. So, you know, it's a short poem, but short of saying, I love that person, which is hard for us to say, we would then say, that's my heart right there. And that was enough to say, I'm protecting that person. I vouch for that person. Yeah.
You might be remembered by that poem.
Yeah.
That's going to be an icon. That could be everyone's poem to someone they love. That's my heart right there. You began early on in the New Yorker Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
What year was that?
The first time I stepped to the stage at the New Yorker Poets Cafe had to be 1991.
Mm.
Yeah.
I know some of the originals there, and they did a great deal to change the world. But did they notice who you were right away, or did they embrace you, or did they just give you a stage? How were they in your development?
Well, you know, it was the it was an underground scene to begin with. There were no red velvet ropes. There were no, there wasn't even, Julio wasn't even there at the front. He was, as you stepped into the door, he was, you know, waiting for you for sure. So you had to go through him to get into the cafe. But there were no signs. It was just a door. And you could have walked right by the New Yorker Poets Cafe in 91 and not know that, you know, there was a scene that was about to explode inside there. I think once I started reading poems, my impression was that, Bob Holman was one of the sort of main developers of the reincarnation of the New Yorker Poets Cafe, which was founded really in the 70s by Miguel Argarín and Piñero and a bunch of the other New Yorker poets who needed a space to read their poems and workshop them as well. So, but once the late 80s, early 90s came around, they reopened it. But they reopened it and introduced a slam to New York, which really originated in Chicago. So my impression was that once I started reading my poems, that I was definitely in a lineage at that point. It was clear that I had been reading the Harlem Renaissance. It had been clear that I had been reading Black arts poets. It was clear that I had been reading. I read the whole New Yorker anthology, the first one that Argarín and Piñero put together. But really, Argarín sort of setting up the blueprint for what it meant to be a New York Puerto Rican poet, the idea of being an outlaw poet, the idea that somehow writing poems was used as a survival, that you could bring more than one tongue to the poem, right? You could bring your native tongue, you could bring your mother tongue, you could bring your uptown tongue, right? If need be, you could even write in Spanish. So once I started reading those poems, it was clear that, you know, I was coming out of a tradition. I really was not interested in the slam per se. I was invited by Paul Beatty to come down, and he was one of the first he was the first, I think champ, whatever, the winner of the slam. He said, yo, you know, you should come down and meet some folks down there. And then another writer, Kevin Powell, had told me about the New Rican. So I had read about it in The Voice. And so I went down there thinking I was just going to read some poems. And I got there and I saw the scores being held up. And I told Paul, like, oh, what is this? And I was like, oh, my God, it's a contest. It's a swim contest for poets, basically, right? Who has the best figure? Who has the best technique? And so I started reading poems, and, you know, I just one round after another. And then before I know it, I was in Chicago reading against Patricia Smith in one of the first national slams that October. But then after that, that was the definite end of my slam life. But I learned a lot reading poems out loud at the New Rican Poets Cafe, because it's a give and take proposition. It's a communal proposition. And you also kind of learn how to edit your poems on the spot when you read out loud. And that was one of the benefits of being at the cafe. And there was so many sort of innovative and original voices. I mean, Dale Landesmith was coming through, Tracy Morris was there, Dana Bryant, Maggie Estep, rest in peace, Edwin Torres, Mike Tyler was there, Reggie Gaines came through. It was a really an eclectic, sort of rich assortment. Ed Morales was there, of poets, and then you had the Village crowd come through, you had the old school Lower East Side come through. So there was one night, I remember I was reading a poem and I looked to my left, and at the bar, you could see Pedro Pietri was there. Miguel Algarin was right standing next to him. Bimbo Rivas was there. I mean, it was like one, you know, icon after another. And I had known all of these poets through my readings. And that was a definite highlight. And then I met Jesus Papoleto Melendez. I said Sandy Esteves was there. So, you know, all these sort of voices that were pivotal in my youth for as far as my study of poetry, it was all there. And then the backdrop for it was hip hop music, which was really, really exciting, because hip hop was starting to take risks at that point. So it was hip hop playing. Of course, I had, you know, Sisa playing at the New Rican Poets Cafe. So Ray Barreto would play at the intermissions, and I felt right at home.
Give them a place and they will come. Give them a place and they will come. Everyone needs a place. And you have carried it forth, I think, as kind of a beacon from that group, because you have gone further and farther and deeper and broader and made it mainstream a little bit, which is what everything has to be. It's got to reach a lot of people. So Willie Perdomo is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We'd love to hear another poem.
I'll read one more from, I had two more on the list, but let me see which one I can read here.
Give us three.
Yeah, this is called You Lose Something Every Day. By this point, we're definitely midway down the book, and they have already lost a friend. And it was Dre that they lost. You lose something every day. It was Dre who once said, you lose something every day. Your mind on the way to the store, the floor on the way to your mind. Your mind on your way to the clinic on the way to one more. The mad in the way of your kind, the lyrics to your favorite song. The cure on the way to the camp, the finish on your way to the line. Your nickel in the way of a dime, the short to your favorite long, the loss on the way to the find, the skin that was yours to bear, the crown that was yours to wear, the floor you were forced to clean, the game that was yours to fare, the face you were pushed to mean. It was Dre who once said, you lose something every day.
There you go, anchoring the last line again, so that we know somebody's in charge of this thing. Nothing like a list, is there, Willie? There's nothing like a list to get momentum.
And I think so. Yeah, absolutely. This is something that was really intentional about the Crazy Bunch. And, you know, I've been reading Whitman for sure. By the time I was working my way toward the book, and the way he was using catalog, and then if you sort of mix that with, you know, the spoken word sort of tendency to go with the chant, to go with the list poems as well. So I wanted to sort of get all of it in there. So you got chants, you have repetition, you have guzzles, you know, you have, you know, these kind of forms that you reimagine, you have lyric, high lyric, if you will, to balance out some of the list as well.
So I'm glad you're telling us that you have to read in order to write. At least, do you have to know your antecedents, that we're not inventing the universe, we're just broadening it, really? And you are very, very well read. This shows up in every line. Did you ever think about John Ashbery? When I first read John Ashbery, none of the work was literal, and there were a lot of invisible bridges in there, but the energy made me jump off my chair. And that's what happened with you. When I first met you on the page, your energy just absolutely became color, physical color on the page to me. So is there something we can do to believe in our cosmic energy and to cultivate it?
I think you have to tap into the source, the origin of any storytelling tendency you might have, because whether you're learning how to tell stories in the kitchen, whether you're learning how to listen to them on the stoop, whether you're learning how to perform the stories. And when I say that, I'm talking about how a story sort of comes through your body as you're telling it, as you're standing up and your hands are moving, you're accenting pivotal moments in the story by staying still and raising your voice. And so I was witness to all this. I think it was Gail Jones who said that the ability to hear is pivotal if you are going to write. And she would sort of, you know, point out Joyce as a sort of paragon of somebody who could listen, who knew how to hear. Chaucer, the same way, knew how to hear. So that ability, I think, is very pivotal. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned John Ashbery, because I was at some point making my way toward the New York School as I was thinking about my own sort of trajectory and thinking about, where do I sort of land after the Harlem Renaissance? Where do I land after the Umber poets? Where do I land after the New Eureka poets? Where do I land after the Black Arts Movement? Where do I land after the Beat poets? And then the New York School sort of introduced themselves into my reading as well. More so on the Frank O'Hara side, I'd say, where the idea of capturing a sort of what seems to be a mundane, the day Lady Day died. When I wrote The Day Hector Lavoe Died, it was in that vein. That poem showed up in Smoking Lovely. But one of the poets that I really gravitated to was a poet named Frank Lima, who was part of that school, who was connected to that. His word combinations for me was surreal. And this was something that, you know, I remember sort of being resonant in my readings as well. So the ability to mix the abstract with the concrete, that somehow the construction of a poem could hold both.
Willie, I'm looking for a book of essays from you. I'm looking for that anthology you're talking about. I'm looking for at a film from you. I'm looking at you creating music from language. Now let us have a closing poem.
Okay. This is towards the very end of the book, and it's called On Sundays.
Which book is this, Willie?
This is cool. You know what? Maybe I'll switch it up. I'll do something from the Essential Hits of Shorty Bumba.
Shorty Bumba. Honest to God, wherever did you get that?
Well, Shorty Bumba is actually a sort of a legendary figure in New Eureka poet lore. I had never met him, but I think he had told me about him. So using the name Shorty Bon Bon was a way to pay tribute to the New Eureka School and the New Eureka Poets Cafe, for sure. And it's a very percussive name, and it's a book about a drummer, a percussionist, right? So
I love the way you have the pages talking to each other.
Yes, yes. So this is one of the poems. I'm going to read just very two short poems and from it. This one comes from a voice Rose, and Rose is Shorty Bon Bon's love. You know, part of my, you know, when I write these books, I always have to make space for love. I always have to make space for, I'm really, really interested in the conceit of the singular love, right? What that actually means, right? And not so necessarily sort of the muse, because the muses, they never get to talk back. But in this particular, you know, instance, you know, Rose actually talks back to Shorty. So I'll read one Dear Shorty, and then I'll read another poem to close out here. Dear Shorty, number 4. And if you saw me falling, what would you yell from the great street? What is all this mess you talk about when you talk about love? This zubang, this funhouse. Could be swing, could be slide, this ball, this diesel. What is this thing you call cure and sickness? Tell me, if you feature or go first, what good is reason to the last set? When you read the stains at the bottom of my coffee cup, be careful. You might feel more like a monster than a tree. And what looks like a monster is really a tree. If I had a license, you might say true. You might say that all the beautiful discoveries usually come late to the party. And this is the last poem in the book, written by yet another voice, the unidentified poet that Shorty is talking to throughout the entire book. Shorty is on his way out by this point. Again, there's an arc in this book, a life cycle for sure. And this is the very last poem in the book that the poet has been trying to write. And it's really a lesson in writing too, right, Grace? Like, he's been trying to write this poem almost 7 different times. And he's just kind of, this is his last attempt. The birth of Shorty Bon Bon, final take. Drum, the ground in the zero. Drum, the quake in the earth. Drum, the one in the two. Drum, the death in the birth. Drum, the harang in the kangkang. Drum, the bomb in the bomba. Drum, the cha in the cha-cha. Drum, the hrumba hrumbao. Drum, the tumba tumbao. Drum, the dong in the ding. Drum, the pop in the smooth. Drum, the cry in the croon. Drum, the black in the hole. Drum, the sand in the time. Drum, the bend in the pitch. Drum, the reason the rhyme. Drum, the sugar, the trade. Drum, the slap in the silly. Drum, the song in the belly. Drum, the moose in the call. Drum, glissando. Drum, glissando. Drum, you.
The voice of Willie Perdomo, the fearless voice of Willie Perdomo. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. It's produced by Forest Wood Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipid Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.